It's Classroom Technology Day on Wells Tech. We're joined by Gail Potrat to discuss the future of textbooks. Sounds serious. Not really. It's a lot of fun. I think you'll enjoy it, too. Stay tuned. This is Wells Tech, a podcast on the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. Welcome back, everybody. This is another episode of the Wells Tech Podcast. In fact, episode 225 for Wednesday, February 29th, 2012. And joining me as usual from Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Martin. We made it to the fifth Wednesday in February. I've been amazed at February for that reason.
sounds like a math teacher.
Yeah. Don't know when it'll happen again.
Does
so
not happen very often. Exactly. And joining us on our classroom technology focused show, as usual, Gail Potrat. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, everyone.
How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good. Did you get any of this nasty snow that we got down here south?
We did not.
Well, that's
how much snow
that's
do you
a switch.
Have today?
We had about 6 inches this morning.
Oh my goodness! So. Wow. No. We are still pretty much snowless as we have been throughout the winter. People were just complaining yesterday that we haven't had a snow day.
Yeah, I was up at 5 o'clock this morning shoveling the driveway, so I could get down and up. So heavy stuff, but that's okay. We cannot complain about what we've had this winter. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we are focusing on classroom technology, and one thing that's been in the news a lot and something that we probably should spend some time talking about is digital textbooks or textbooks in general and their future. Apple came out with a recent announcement about their iBooks initiative and their iAuthor software. We've heard various rumblings from other sources that they're going to be doing this, including Google. So I guess the big question is, what does this mean for the for our Wells classrooms, and what should we be paying attention to?
Well, first of all, we should be paying attention to why we're using those new devices to deliver the content. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good place to start this discussion. Yeah. Although for the next few years, we'll be talking a lot about devices and delivery of content. We still would do well to remember that we're actually talking about this for a bigger reason. Mm-hmm. And that is facilitating this transformation from an older way of teaching to a more relevant way of preparing our kids for the future. And online textbooks are just one tool, again, to in the bigger picture of how we create lessons and how we do prepare the kids. So I think that's a good thing to remember foundationally before we talk about the devices themselves.
Sure. And when we say devices, there's kind of, in my mind, there's four categories, and maybe there's even more that I'm not thinking of. There's the traditional laptop computer. There are these netbooks, the smaller, the mini versions. There are the Chromebooks, we're a little bit different animal, which really don't have a lot of internal storage. And finally, the tablets, or most notably the iPads. But I think you're right on, Gail. It really doesn't matter what device you use. It's really about the learning experience, the content, and how the teacher adapts both the content and the devices in that learning environment.
Exactly. And I guess I was very satisfied with doing one-to-one computing in our eighth grade for the past, 3 or 4 years. And we'd always been using the math book, which I still think is perfect, even though it is now extinct. Mm-hmm. Because to me, that combines both. You have you can get the online app if you're a Google App school. You can get the online app features and use of Google Docs in that respect. And yet you can create an iMovie. We've got some pretty powerful tools there for the very creative, innovative type stuff that an iPad does.
Right.
But we're being driven toward these devices away from the laptop. Well, first of all, for us, We want to promote it throughout more grades than the eighth grade, and it's just too expensive to get an iBook or a MacBook for everyone. But also, the companies themselves are really driving us toward, I think, the smaller handheld devices rather than the laptops.
Sure.
And as we see more and more content developed for those, then it becomes like a carrot out there to make us want to get our kids onto those devices and experience this multimedia delivery of content as opposed to the flat text based content that we're more used to. You know, Martin, you talked about the four categories. I think the big category is BYOD, bring your own device, where it's going to be a mashup of all those different categories, where ultimately the students are going to have their own, and we're going to need to support and deliver content to a combination of those categories.
Yeah, that really complicates things. I think another trend I'm seeing, and you two can correct me if I'm wrong, is that a lot of the materials that are out there, regardless of platform, are really centered around subject areas, and that's, you know, that's I guess to be expected. But that's good news, because if you are focused on a particular subject, let's say you're an English teacher or a math teacher, there are singular places to go for those kinds of resources, including digital textbooks, resources, YouTube videos, those kinds of things. And while that may not be the way the departmentalization concept may not be in every school, I think it still makes it easier to find stuff if you can look at it by topic and by grade level. And that's what I think, that's how the industry is evolving, especially in these digital textbook areas.
Right, and it does take a lot of time to find your own resources.
For sure, yeah.
So if you've got the online textbook, well, it's just like a regular textbook. If it covers your curriculum, you've got that part of your job is done. You've got the collection of material. And just like a regular textbook, it doesn't mean you can't veer away from that, include other things, maybe even a paper book along the way. So, you know, it's always going to be a collection. But I think that that's a good point that you make. I was interested in seeing this textbook from this Nature's Publishing Group, and I really hadn't been aware of them till just the other day when I was looking at things getting ready for this podcast. And they have developed a $49, it's a science book of type, I think it might be biology. They only have one at this point, but their thing is delivered through a browser. Okay, so any device, not just the iPad, any browser. And they constantly update this. So it's a science book. It's being constantly updated. And they made the claim in there that they think it's going to take 10 to 15 years before online text really take hold. This is just the beginning, the dabblings, the texts that are device-dependent. And then I like this one because it's not text-dependent. You can use it with any browser on any device. And
right.
Ultimately, don't you think that's where we're headed? Kudos to Apple for getting the ball rolling. But I really can't see that they're going to – I could be wrong, but I don't think they're going to have the corner on this market.
Not until they can provide – well, they're locking in their content to their devices, which makes sense. They're a hardware company. They make good hardware, and it works well, and I think it works well in educational settings. But the barrier to entry with their products is the cost.
Right.
You know, the cheapest iPad you can get is $500, and yep. I'm not sure iPads are the optimal I know schools do it. But in the hands of elementary kids, that just seems a little dicey as far as, you know, their durability, their ability to stay whole and operational is a little bit iffy. So maybe Apple's thinking about that. I know Google's thinking about that with their Chromebooks, and other manufacturers probably are too. So if somebody's interested in starting exploring this, where do they start? What do they do? Where does a principal start, or somebody who's in charge of this, as far as looking at what's out there, or is it too early?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've been looking because we've realized we want to move more and more into the one-to-one, and we cannot support it with the MacBook.
Mm-hmm. Cost-wise. That's what it cost, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So I've been looking at devices for, I'm going to say, 2 years now. And first started, we got like 4 iPads, okay, which isn't, you know, it's a limited amount, but it's just like when you started with, remember the old book, the one computer, teaching in the one computer classroom?
Right.
It's the same concept. Things can be done. So played around with those. This is our second year that we've had those. And very quickly discovered that, you know, this is not what I'm going to do for a whole classroom at one time. The management problem, you know, with the applications,
right.
and it's just not easy. So I do have a few comments on how I've learned how to improve that, but let me go ahead with, I kind of put that aside, and then at the beginning of this year, or in the summer, I really started looking at the Google Chromebook,
mm-hmm.
and I did end up this year now with a proposal before our school board and our council to start that in the sixth grade, mm-hmm. and every year put those into the sixth grade and then move them up, you know, because it's a 3-year cycle, right?
Right?
Google runs the program. So that's kind of sitting out there right now looking at funding to make that a possibility here. Since that time that I did that, Apple came out with their announcement, and so, of course, I went back and looked at all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Talked to a lot of people, listened to a lot of people, find out there's a lot of people that are doing both, bigger schools that...
Oh, really?
Yeah, they have my friends down in the Milwaukee area that I work with from the Stevens Group. Many of them are doing the approach where they have a cart full of Chromebooks and they have a cart full of iPads, and kids are able to pick the tool depending on the task.
Depending on the application, right.
Which mm-hmm. is ideal, you know, that's ideal. It's not truly one-to-one. You get into this whole discussion of what is, you know, one-to-one. Do you want one kid with one device all day long? That's
mm-hmm.
truly one-on-one, you know.
Right, right.
If you take an iPad and you put it in your classroom, and kids use it, and then you leave it in your classroom, and the next group of kids come in to use those same iPads, okay, now you've got a management issue.
Right.
Now, some people I've learned recently, luckily I have friends who are way further ahead than I am on this stuff, and I've learned from them. People, what they're doing is the iPads come with, they call this Brentford Sync Cart, okay? So they're getting a cart full of iPads, which comes with, used to be a MacBook, now I guess it's the Mac Air, mm-hmm. whatever. And they are able to really sync, you know, they use the one MacBook and they hook all the computers up to this cart, and they can sync applications and everything all at once across all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's way better than what I was trying to do.
Right.
Right. And also, another thing they do is they use the iPad almost more like a Chromebook, in the sense that they use the cloud, you know, the Dropbox.
Sure.
It used to be MobileMe, but now...
iCloud.
iCloud and that type of thing. And even Edmodo and the teacher and the kids communicate through those accounts as far as handing in things back and forth.
So it's not device dependent. It really, you can use
right.
any device. And that's kind of the Chromebook concept, too. It's
right.
all in Google Docs, right?
So in that way, you can manage, okay, as long as kids close out their personal accounts,
mm-hmm.
when the next group comes in, they log into their accounts and those things, and they use the device.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. It's almost like using it like a Chromebook, but yet you do have the features to create some pretty cool stuff on mm-hmm. the iPad, too. So
right.
People are finding their way around that, I guess.
Yep. We're going to put in the show notes a bunch of resources that kind of discuss the differences between iPads and Chromebooks. And I've done a couple blog posts and did a whole series on Chromebooks, and Gail's got a PowerPoint on that as well. So let's put the devices aside for a second and just talk about content. What's out there? What's available today to put on these devices? What could a teacher use? Or is it just kind of a hybrid approach right now where you got a little of this and a little of that? What do you guys see?
Well, speaking from the hybrid point of view, many, many print traditional textbooks are now coming with an online component to them. Mm-hmm. So you have video lessons that go along with it, or in our case, we have some students with reading disabilities, so they're able to have the textbook read to them by going to the website and using software on the web. So I think the textbook world is trying to respond and trying to be more media driven mm-hmm. In that way. So I think you see a lot of progress in that regard. And so that doesn't require a one-to-one computer setting, but, you know, a couple of computers that could be shared in the classroom for delving into some of those more advanced features that are available online.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if you want to start right now and you don't have iPads, so you can't – there's not a ton of textbooks that are particularly useful to our grade schools that are out there right now for the iPad. You know, you can go to iTunes University, which now can contain K through 12 content. But if you look at it, you're probably not going to find too much of what you're teaching in your classroom right now until that people take the, the authoring tool to heart and start populating that, because that's just kind of all beginning. And I can see some huge things that can happen there. You can basically write your own textbook for your kids, your fourth grade social studies. Mm-hmm. You know, gather your content and put it together, and that will be your place that you host it, and kids can go get it from there. I can see that that could be huge once you have time to pull it all together as a teacher and do that. But right now, you can't go out there and get that because it's just not there. Mm-hmm. But there are resources like this Nature's Publishing textbook. There, that's only one biology textbook. So unless you're teaching high school biology, that doesn't do you much good.
Right.
But what you can do right now, and not even doing one-to-one, you certainly could do this. There are tons of sites out there on the Internet, the CK Flexible Text site, which has content in many, many grade school areas right now. Math and science, if you look at any of these, it's so obvious that the whole STEM concept is really out there, because as a language arts teacher, I feel neglected. There's really never much there, but it's definitely driven, science and math driven from what I see. And like that flexible textbook site, they give you textbooks, like a sixth grade math textbook, and it's unit by unit, and you actually can build your own textbook. There is one there, and you can delete units if you want. You can actually upload your own content and include it in that textbook. So you're building your own textbook.
Sure.
It's already started for you. Yeah. And then you have your choice of how you want it. You can deliver that with paper if you want. You can have a PDF file mm-hmm. of it, or you can deliver it all online. There's several choices.
Sure.
And this is free. So, I mean, there are ways of gathering content in that respect right now. That's just one mm-hmm. site that allows you to do that.
I think even a year ago we had talked a little bit about a project where a classroom was building their own textbook. So it wasn't just the teacher, but they were involving the students in the creation process.
Right. Yeah, you remember that.
Using a wiki.
Right.
I think it was wasn't it social studies?
I think so.
Doing a history thing? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So gathering online resources and then formatting it and hopefully making it usable. So,
right.
And, you know, there's no better way to learn than to teach, and that's, I think, the concept there.
Yep, exactly.
Sally, we've got a number of other resources. I just want to make sure before we leave the conversation we're mentioning those. Anything we left out here?
Well, I think we can point people to a recent Mashable article with five places to get digital textbooks.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then certainly if you haven't checked out the Apple iBooks author, there's great resources online to introduce you to that.
Sure.
And then Gail has other links that she shared with us. One that I thought was particularly interesting was a podcast about an inner city Chicago classroom, third and fourth grade, I think. They're using iPads and how she's taken it kind of to the next level She's using a Stammer pedagogy model that really promotes digital integration. And so if you're just using it to play games and drill, maybe you want to listen to this podcast and get some ideas about further integration, not just of an iPad, but any kind of multimedia device that might take your teaching to another level.
Yep, very good. Interesting stuff. This probably will not be the last time we discuss this, as this is probably on many teachers' minds as they're looking both to start using more digital resources, but how to put this, you know, maybe more formal way into the curriculum, and then once the students have these devices in hand, how do you marry those two? So interesting stuff. Very good. Should we move on to ministry resources, Sally?
Yeah, this was actually a find I believe you tagged for us in our Wells Tech Digo group, Martin. It's from BiblePronunciations.com.
Right.
And it is an iOS app, so only available for the iPhone, iPod Touch, iPad at this time.
Right. From what I read, and I haven't tried it, but it's just a little app that allows you to type in any biblical name, or it actually lists all the biblical names. You can search for them, and then it's a pronunciation guide, which can be a challenge, I think, both in the classroom and from the pulpit or from the lectern, too, as you know, there are a lot of names here that obviously we don't use in our everyday English vernacular at this point. So this is just a little tool, and one of the apps gives kind of the variations of it, where it's found in the Bible. You can click on links and read about that person, sometimes links to Wikipedia and so on and so forth. So a nice little app, and I believe, I didn't check whether it was free or not. I would hope it's free.
There's a
surcharge?
There's two flavors. There's a light version that
That's
gives
right.
you 400
okay.
names, and then there's the full-blown version, which they are continuing to develop. It's kind of funny. When I went to their website, it said get the full-blown version. We have 2,200 names and growing, and actually now they have about 3,800 names in there. And so their goal is to cover all the proper nouns in the Bible. So they've got a ways to go, but they have a really cool intro video that I found.
Right,
so check out the links and check out the app if you're going to make use of that.
Good ministry resource this week. Let's move on to picks of the week. Gail, you're semi-regular, so that makes you first in our eyes.
Okay, I'm semi-normal.
did not right. say that.
my pick of the week, if you would like to take a look at it, I actually put a sample in here using it. It's called present.me. And I did my little in-service for my faculty on online texts and where we're headed, where we might be headed. I used this. So in the show notes, if you take a look there, you can see actually how it works. Caveat, that's not really my presentation. This was my practice with the tool. Mm-hmm. So it's not a full-blown presentation, but you get the idea, and all the links are there in the presentation for you to go ahead. So I kind of try to kill two birds with one stone. There's some good information in there. But the present.me is a site that allows you to record your PowerPoint, upload your PowerPoint, play the PowerPoint, and then it's kind of like the little talking head idea where you are allowed to talk and speak to the PowerPoint as you're flipping the slides and playing it, and then this is all recorded together so you could save it and share it with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that it's very useful. Once in a while, we'll have something we put on our website where, for example, our staff minister, family minister, will give a little short talk, you know, on a particular subject, and he likes to use PowerPoint. So he'll use the PowerPoint and talk about it, and he thinks it's more effective to be able to see the person, you know, talking. It just adds a little more interest. So we use it for that kind of thing. But for in-service like this and saving it, now anybody can pull this up and play the in-service over for themselves at a later time, too. It's another way to do that. So the photography, it's not crystal clear. It's a little grainy. The picture, you know, it's not highest quality video by any means, but it is free, and it does the trick, does the job. It's you can in the basic free account, you're limited to 15 minutes, and a 50 megabyte upload, I believe. Mm-hmm. So there's some limitation. They do have, of course, pay for plans that go up there, but I just use the free one.
Looks
and
like
it works well.
Looks like it's still in beta. Did you say that you could capture your own image via a webcam and embed that like a picture-in-picture, or is it just the screen, just the PowerPoint itself?
No, it does that. It shows your PowerPoint,
cool.
And then it shows you talking.
You.
It,
awesome.
It's like a little Camtasia studio, mm-hmm. for free.
It's more like side-by-side images, Martin, than picture-in-picture.
I gotcha.
So,
okay.
Yeah, it's pretty large.
Yes.
Image
side-by-side. Big image, yep, way up there.
So you got to put your makeup on to do it.
That's right.
Well, won't be seeing me doing this.
All right. Thank you, Gail. Good pick. Sally?
My turn?
Yep.
Okay. I came across a new mind map that I wanted to share with everyone. In the past, I've shared some that I've created where I've used these for presentations and things where I use a mind map and people can access it later and it has all the links embedded to cool stuff that I've talked about or whatever. And I actually stole that idea from a presenter that I saw at a conference once. And her name is Maria Anderson. We actually had her on the show many years ago.
Right.
She came on and talked to us. She's a community college math teacher over in Michigan. And she's also pretty well-versed on the speaker circuit. She does a lot of talking about using technology in the math classroom and integrating it into your curriculum. And she puts together these really awesome mind maps. She uses MindDomo, which is an online mind map hosting service. And then, like I said, you can easily share those mind maps via the web, and anyone can visit them and make use of it. So I found a new one that Maria's built called Play and Learn. And this is actually a subject-specific mind map, so pretty much covering everything that is taught from K through 12, at least, all different kinds of subjects. And as you expand the mind map, then she has basically games around that particular subject area. So you can integrate some gaming with your students to help them learn concepts from biology and physics to economics and philosophy and political science. Of course, she's got English and music and art, and she has a completely separate mind map just loaded with mathematics games. And so, yeah, pretty heavy on the STEM side of things, Gail. Mm-hmm. I know what you're thinking.
Yeah, well, I heard the word English in there, so at least.
That's right. She's got English. It's at the top of the map, as a matter of fact.
All right.
So lots of really cool links here. I headed for computer science and spent some time playing the binary game yesterday where it scrolls off binary challenges and you're trying to figure out the numbers that are being represented with the ones and zeros. So just one example, and I'm thinking there's something for all of our educators who are listening today in Maria's Play and Learn mind map, something new that you haven't used in your classroom, I bet.
Cool.
Well, I know where I'm headed today.
There you go.
Nice. Thank you, Sally. My pick is for Windows users only. I'll preface it with that. It is a simple, free utility called Image Resizer. I've been looking around for something like this for a while, and there are all kinds of online tools and tools like Photoshop and GIMP and those kinds of things. But sometimes really all you want to do is just as quickly as possible resize an image. And that's what this little utility does. You download it, you install it, and what happens is when it installs itself in what I call the context or right-click menu. So when you are on a file, let's say a picture that you want to resize, and you right-click, you get all those options. Like edit, print, preview, rotate, those kinds of things. But this installs itself, and it just simply says resize pictures. And when you click resize pictures, it presents you with a little window, and it says you have selected to resize one or more photos. You can do more than one at once.
Nice.
And you've got some presets, so you can go small, medium, large, or mobile. The small is 854 by 480 or whatever dimension it is that you want. It does it proportionally. all the way up to large, which is 1920 by 1080. So some of these large megapixel cameras that are much larger than that, this is a real easy way to just downsize these to something that's more usable on your screen, all the way down to mobile, which is 320, and then it has a custom where you can scale it to whatever dimensions you want. And then you have an option of replacing the originals or creating a copy. So you're not always having to worry about, well, I'm not gonna have my big picture anymore. So it works really well, quick, easy. It works on almost any image that your computer can recognize. So BMPs, JPEGs, GIFs, PNGs, all those TIFFs, I think, even. Just works really well. It does one thing and does it well. So it's it was a great find for me, and I would advise everybody running Windows at least to install Image Resizer for Windows.
Excellent. You said the magic words when you said you can do more than one at once. I think that's one of the biggest challenges is dealing with individual pictures. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we talk about that in our final web courses, don't we, mm-hmm. Sally? Where you take 20 pictures of classroom activity or field trip, and then you got all this stuff, and you can't use it. I mean, they're huge coming off
they're
of these megapixel ready. Cameras. Yeah, and there are other tools out there, but this is probably the simplest way to do it.
So. Awesome. Thank you.
Sure. Community feedback this week.
Oh, yeah. We have some great links being shared on the DIGO website. I'm going to save the best for last because I'm really excited about one in particular. But we'll start by talking about a link to 101 ways to use the Interactive Whiteboard or SmartBoard in your data projector. I was really excited to find this wiki page. I think it's a EduWiki or whatever they're called. But anyway, and it's titled 100 different ways, but I think they're up to over 110 now. So just a huge list of ways to make use of a smart board. Skype the experts, using microscope, kid action songs, wordles, optical illusions, teaching punctuation. It's not very categorized or organized. It's just a big, amazingly long list that I'm sure there are some new things here that you haven't thought of with doing with your projectors and interactive whiteboards. So check out this wiki page.
Great.
Another one that I tagged for DIGO, and I debated about making this one my pick of the week because I was really excited to find it, and it is the Adobe Education Exchange. I was doing some reading this week and ended up on this website reading about a project by an art teacher who had recorded a series of videos teaching Photoshop for his digital design class. And I was really excited and impressed that there was this whole community around Adobe products. So this is not STEM related, Gail. This is for the art teachers, really, in okay. the audience. And it is organized by grade level and has a vast number of project ideas and step-by-step instructions for implementing different art/Adobe-related projects in your classroom. The caveat is that you need to create an account to get to all that great content. So if you don't have an Adobe account yet, then that's one to add to your password list.
That's free.
Yeah, you can definitely set up a quick and easy free account and then get access to all this great content and then also contribute to the community as well. So check out the Adobe Education Exchange.
Very good. And last but not least,
Martin, your list is shorter than mine. I have a longer list.
Oh, do you?
Just a few. Yeah, we didn't sync our mind maps just the greatest, did
okay,
we?
Okay, keep going. Okay, I'll shut up.
I got more to go. Okay.
Just tell me when I should talk.
I'll do that. I wanted to share a link to Evernote for Schools, a new site put together by the Evernote folks, specifically for using Evernote in education settings. So there's a blog that introduces it, and then we'll have the link to the Evernote for Schools website as well. And then I wanted to share the link. I think maybe our friend Ryan Rosenthal, who's very science-oriented, shared a link to Sponge Lab, a global science community. So back on the STEM channel again, if you're looking for science resources, you might want to check out this website.
Is that related to SpongeBob?
I don't know where they got that name. I didn't see any little square sponges on there, but you never know. Looked pretty scientific. And last but not least,
now we're ready.
I think we need to talk about this recent David Pogue article that pointed to a new app for the iPad. Mm-hmm. It's called OnLive Desktop. And Martin, you said you were familiar with this. You're way ahead of the curve on this one. This is basically a Windows emulator or a Windows environment that will run successfully on the iPad. Mm-hmm. So you launch this app and you're basically, if I understand it correctly, running a thin client solution.
Correct.
To a server farm that has some mega fast Windows PCs available, so you can launch a desktop and work with Microsoft Word, Excel, and PowerPoint completely free. You create a free account on the OnLive Desktop website, and you can synchronize the files that you're working with through that account and get blazing fast speed in the process. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to pay $5 a month, you can surf using Internet Explorer and also have Adobe Reader available to you. And the Internet Explorer experience includes Flash. So you can run Flash on your iPad.
Wow.
I'm stunned.
And you know,
late last night and play with it, and it worked.
It works well.
That's pretty amazing, yeah.
The challenge, couple challenges, is because of the size of the screen and the fatness, at least of my finger, it's sometimes hard to hit all the buttons that you need to press in some of those interfaces because it's not optimized in any way for touch. I mean, it's Microsoft Word. It's Excel. It's whatever. So I think they'll probably work on that. It's probably a great candidate for using a stylus even because then you can get a little bit more precise.
Well, you could use your Bluetooth keyboard too. And
oh, absolutely. For typing, for sure. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. But I'm just talking about
the full function ribbon up at the top. I mean, 100%. Mm-hmm. All the different.
Yeah, it's the whole thing. There's no shortcuts. The second caveat is you can't leave the screen and then come back without having to log in again and starting over. So while you can save documents, you can't go to another. You can't multitask, basically. So you've got to save it, leave the app, come back, and log in again. So it doesn't retain the session state. So I'm sure they're going to have to figure that out. But
What would be the advantage of using this other than going to Google Docs and, you know, uploading and downloading your document there and working that way?
Well, Google Docs is going to convert any Word. So if you have to work in the Microsoft world, this is probably a make sense solution.
Okay.
So Google Docs is going to convert your Word doc into Google Doc format. Here it just remains Word or Excel or PowerPoint.
Okay. And I was just going to say, you can multitask within the application.
Oh, sure. You can have multiple windows open. It's like you're working on a Windows machine.
Absolutely, it is. But if you leave the application, say to jump over to your Facebook app or your email app.
Or Safari or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Then you're going to be shutting down your session on the thin client, and you have to relaunch that session,
reopen the document you were working on or whatever. That's kind of why it's a win to have Internet Explorer there, because a lot of the times when you are multitasking, you're going out to the web to look at something. So that's a good reason to use that Internet Explorer.
Ante up the $5 a month.
$5,
huh?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think for $10 a month, I don't know if this is rolled out yet. For $10 a month, I think it ups your storage to like 50 gigs, something like that. So
something in the Pogue article said that they're trying to figure out how to be able to offer you all of your software or your major software that you have purchased and licensed.
Install your own apps, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So then their pristine servers that are virus-free are running your apps, and you don't have to worry about managing all that and stuff. So
Interesting
stuff. Sounds
like
a winning situation.
Yeah, and they are working on Android versions as well, so it's not just going to be iPad. Right now it's only iPad, but I think other Android tablets will have it too.
They showed the guy next to a big TV screen doing a PowerPoint presentation with it projecting on a – or showing on a TV, you know, so lots of power there.
Well,
yeah, that'd be really a way to expand the use of the iPad for people.
Sure.
Yeah. Along those same lines, when you mentioned the flash, if you're just worried about the flash issue on the iPad, there's an app called Rover, R-O-V-E-R, like the dog. Mm-hmm. There's an app you can get that is actually a browser for the iPad that will allow you to do Flash.
Okay,
that's kind of a neat thing. And also, you were mentioning your resizing thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to throw in quickly the what we do when we use Final Web here, and when you're batch resizing all your photos for your gallery or whatever, we use a free tool called Shrink-O-Matic.
Yep. I'm aware of that. That's an app. That's a standalone app that you download, right?
And that works. That works really well for that.
Yep, I've recommended that in the past too. Good.
Okay.
All right, that should about do it for this week. Very much appreciate both of you, ladies, in your collective wisdom in classroom technology and other types of technology issues.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we are going to actually kind of stay focused on classroom or educational technologies because it is our second seven best show. And this one is all about teacher resource sites, the seven best teacher resource sites. So if you have a candidate that you would like to nominate for that list, let us know. And there are many ways to do that, going to our website, wellstech.wells.net, sending us an email, wellstech@wells.net. Just go to our show notes page, and you can click any of those icons at the top, and they'll likely give you a way to contact us. So even Pinterest, Sally.
Even Pinterest. You're getting good at that, Martin.
Yeah, I've
like
got
a
two
pro.
Pins now. Yeah.
Ooh.
That's where I put mine, just to get to learn to use that.
Okay.
There you go.
Very good. Let's close the show with the music of Crosswalk Lutheran Ministry and their song, You Are My World. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Has brought me down. I feel like I am lost and can't be found. And when I've given up, you're still around. You pull me up. Take this broken clay, restore it back to life, to work today. Because of all your goodness, I will say your name. Praise. And in all of this you show, you are grace, you are love, you're an everlasting Savior. I am weak, but you are strong, and I will praise your name forever. Praise your name forever. You are my world. You are my world. How could I pretend that any of my works could ever mend a love for me so great? You chose to send your only son. Your love is full and free. And Jesus' sacrifice has covered me. You've given me a life eternally by grace alone. And in all of this I see, you are grace, you are love, you're an everlasting Savior. You are strong, and I will praise your name forever. You are grace, you are love, you're an everlasting Savior. I am weak, but you are strong, and I will praise. Praise your name forever. Praise your name forever.